We have a problem. The problem is going to be the existing level of budget deficits and the existing monetization, because the way that this works in the last part of the cycle, the long-term debt cycle, is first that the debt service payments begin to squeeze out the consumption. And you get to a point where that starts to accelerate in a self-reinforcing problem. That problem precedes the real problem, the bigger problem, which is when there's owners of the debt see this debt problem emerging and there's a big imbalance, and so the central banks come in and print, or they have large losses. And as a result of that, the owners of those want to sell the bonds. I think we're in the early stages of the last stages.
I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. With the summer now behind us, I thought it'd be a good time to step back and make sense of some of the more important issues facing investors today. And who better to do that with than Bridgewater founder and CIO mentor, Ray Dalio. Through my 20 years of working with Ray, I always find it incredibly valuable how Ray brings the conversation up a level and creates very compelling cause and effect frameworks. These frameworks, almost always rooted in research into hundreds of years of economic cycles, can be effective prisms for seeing today's global conditions more clearly and how they might play out. In today's discussion, Ray lays out his five big forces framework. Those forces are, one, the financial and economic force of the dynamics of massive debt accumulation; two, the internal domestic order force; three, the international world order in terms of great power relations; and then also four and five, acts of nature and technology. We will air part one today, where the emphasis is on the dynamics around the financial and economic force and the connection to the domestic order force. Ray starts with an overview, and then he goes into depth on where we are in the long-term debt cycle. He talks about the risks he's seen for investors, the political situation of increasing internal conflict, and how the financial dynamics at play are impacting society and politics. Now, in part two of this series, which we'll share in another Daily Observations, we'll turn to Ray's comments on the international world order, including his read on the U.S.-China relationship and an assessment of the Chinese economy more broadly. So with that, let's get right into the discussion, beginning with Ray describing his five forces framework. Ray, welcome. It's been a while since we did a podcast together, so I'm eagerly looking forward to this one. I hope you had a great summer. You know, you've been known for studying history and creating frameworks. The latest book you wrote, Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order, had five big forces, and I've outlined them for our listeners. But I wonder if you just take a minute and embellish on the importance of these five forces, and then we can explore some of them and how they're playing out today.
You know, I didn't know really about the five big forces. But what I did learn a long time ago is that things that surprised me often surprised me because they never happened in my lifetime, but they happened many times in history. So there were three big things: the enormous amount of debt creation, are there limits to debt creation, and the amount of printing of money. The second was the internal conflict, which we must agree is unique, the populism of the left and the right, the wealth gaps, the values gaps. And the third, of course, was the great power conflict. Not since the 1930 to 45 period did we have those three things. But I needed to study the rises and declines of reserve currencies, the implications of debt and all of that. So that's why I studied the last 500 years and saw those patterns. In doing that, I also saw that droughts, floods, and pandemics, in other words, acts of nature, had a bigger effect on killing more people and causing more empires to decline than the first three I mentioned. And when we look at climate, of course, it's a big issue. And then number five, of course, is the man's development of technologies. So I saw when those five, how they interacted and how they worked together to create these big cycles, that was, of course, enlightening. So that's why I did the study, you know, to understand today, not the past. And you see these sequences. And so it is now transpiring.
Ray, I want to dig deeper on the financial and economic force with you. You wrote a Bridgewater Daily Observations on August 2nd, and it was titled, What's Going On with the Economy? The Great Wealth Transfer. And we'll link to that in this Daily Observations. In that piece, you describe the impact of the great transfer of wealth that occurred when the fiscal and monetary expansion, starting with the COVID period, shifted the private sector debts to the public sector. And investors have clearly seen the resiliency of the economy in part because the private sector is not as interest rate sensitive. But what's interesting is, what does the high indebtedness of the public sector actually mean for investors going forward? And I think you are excellent on this topic. So if you could just help us all understand that from your perspective.
Yes, I think the most important question regarding all of this, finance, money, inflation, and the value of financial assets, is, are there limits to debt growth? Are there limits to the amount of debt? And how does it work? So we see a pattern over history. A number of years ago, I wrote a study, a book, on the principles for dealing with big debt crises. And I looked at the debt crises, all the big ones, over the last 100 years. And I saw this pattern. You know, there's, and I described it, monetary policy 1, 2, and 3. There's a pattern. Originally, there's an interest rate policy. Originally, money is tied to gold or something hard, and it keeps it hard. But when there's too much printing of money, too much need for credit, that link doesn't work. And then they break that down, and then we go to an interest rate-driven monetary policy. Raise and lower interest rates, and that's the cost of money, and that rations things at the supply-demand align at that interest rate. However, when interest rates can't be lowered anymore and there's a situation where there's an imbalance between the demand for bonds, the demand for credit instruments, and the supply of them, in other words, when the supply is offered a lot more than the free market demand, then there's what I call monetary policy 2, which is quantitative easing. In other words, throughout history, the purchases by the central bank, the printing of money and the purchasing of those bonds. But when that happens, it helps the owners of those bonds. The bonds go up, owners of financial assets make money, but the money does not get trickled down, does not go to the population that it might be desired to go to. And so we go from monetary policy 1, interest rate policy, number monetary policy 2, quantitative easing, to monetary policy 3, when there's a coordination between the fiscal and monetary policy, because a central bank or central government has the ability to tax and spend, but they don't have the ability to create money and credit. Central bank has the ability to create money and credit. And so if you have to get money into the hands of people, what you need to do is have a coordination between those two things. And of course, that happened in a big way, an enormous way, in 2020 through 2022. And it still really is happening in a large way. So there's the sending out the checks. And then with the sending out the checks, there's the borrowing, and the central governments borrow. And as a result, who do they borrow from? Because there's an imbalance. And so the central bank lends them the money by printing the money. And then we have an inflationary cycle, and we have the nature of the dynamics that we've experienced. So in that piece, I just wanted to show, you know, why is the economy doing relatively well? This amount of interest rate increase, very sharp, very abrupt, but why? And when you look at the composition of that, you could see that the household sector benefited a great deal by that transfer of wealth, because they were given a lot of checks. And then also because of the nature of what's going on with demand, on low unemployment rates and higher inflation rates, they benefited from an income point of view. So their incomes were strong, their balance sheets were strong, but that was taken on by the government. And so these things have all happened before repeatedly. That just didn't happen in our lifetimes. And so if you follow those things through and the limitations of debt, okay, how does that mechanics work? Well, of course, one man's debts are another man's financial assets. And if there's not an imbalance, the central banks print money and come in and buy that. And that's what we see. But the nature of that printing of money, as there still needs to be a lot of spending, there needs to be an enormous amount of spending for many, many things, of course. All of that means that that's a lot of debt that the government then gets into. And if you look at history, the central bank tries to achieve a balance. That's why you see a real bond yield now and a real interest rate, which is in, you know, the vicinity of, let's call it 2%. So that's that equilibrium. Now that as we run lower on the savings and so on, we encounter those issues. I want to say that if we're looking at that and we carry that forward, we have a problem. The problem is going to be the existing level of budget deficits and the existing monetization, because the way that this works in the last part of the cycle, the long-term debt cycle, is first that the debt service payments begin to squeeze out the consumption. So in other words, as debt becomes a higher percentage of income and interest rates go up, then debt service payments become greater. And as those debt service payments become greater, that squeezes out consumption. And you go to a point where that starts to accelerate in a self-reinforcing problem. That problem precedes the real problem, the bigger problem, which is when owners of the debt see this debt problem emerging and there's a big imbalance. And so the central banks come in and print, or they have large losses. And as a result of that, the owners of those want to sell the bonds. So just imagine that. So we're seeing that kind of dynamic. The dynamic, consider, for example, the losses of the central banks. All the central banks have significant losses on their bond holdings. And depending on how it's handled, it creates a financial problem. For example, in the UK, those losses by the Bank of England, which account for about 2% of GDP, then have to be funded. And so they go to the central government and the budget has to, they have to give the fund the central bank, they have to go borrow the money. And as they go borrow the money, then that worsens the supply-demand balance. And so as you, a very classic dynamic is, it happens all the time, is that the central banks themselves get into financial difficulty. Now we think, okay, central banks really can't get into financial difficulty, but yes, they do, because as those losses occur and the money has to come from somewhere, then they get into that need to print more and more, and it starts to accelerate. And you see this in many cases, often in emerging countries, but you saw it with the breakdown of the system in 71, the ERM realignment and so on. So that becomes the dynamic in which you can't continue to create a lot of debt. Think about the Bank of Japan. The Bank of Japan has bought an enormous amount of bonds. Think about what those bonds are worth. So now the central bank is in a position. Do they tighten monetary policy? Can they continue to have those levels of borrowing? And do they tighten monetary policy? And if interest rates go up, there's a problem for the Bank of Japan. And this is, by the way, true for most central banks in varying degrees. So that is how that dynamic works. When there's the selling of bonds and there is that inability by central banks to do anything other than print money to try to keep interest rates, real interest rates low, which makes it a negative to hold those bonds. So other free market owners of those bonds want to sell them. You create that kind of a dynamic. And if they don't print the money and buy the bonds, then you have interest rates rise a lot. So the point is that that debt is not good debt. And as a result, you get into that dynamic. I think we're in the early stages of the last stages, meaning that if you, as we do projections of, let's say, over the next 5 years, and particularly over the next few years, the supply-demand issue will be probably bringing in central banks. I think the thing to watch now as the red flag would be, okay, central banks switching to quantitative easing again. I think that that would be the red flag that'll go up.
Let me just explore this a little bit further with you, because I remember sitting with you and many others back before the global financial crisis back in 2006 to 2007. And at the time, most of that debt was in the private sector, or at least there was a big accumulation of debt in the private sector. And I remember this notion that, you know, we're saying like that's not as controllable because it's not as drawn out, and it can trigger exactly what happened, right? There's a crisis and then the economy follows and so on. And you said, you know, all along, the way to manage these things is to transfer that debt and then try and manage it. But it doesn't diminish, it just changes the sense of risks. And I think you're outlining what these risks are now. And the risk is more, as I understand you, currency debasement as a potential risk, because if they choose not to let interest rates soar in this demand supply mismatch for bonds, then they have to print in order to buy because no one else, or at least fewer buyers, are buying. And so currency debasement, inflation, this is what we've seen in emerging markets. We've seen a little bit of that in the UK, not just a little bit, quite a lot of it actually in the UK. So this is what investors need to watch going forward. Is that right?
Yes. And I'd like to direct the people to my book because it looks at 750 cases and it looks at all currencies, all through the last couple of hundred years, and all currencies encounter this. So yes, as you recall, the reason that we anticipated the 2008 financial crisis and had a depression gauge that we put on was because the exact same thing happened in the 1929 to 32 period of hitting a zero interest rate when there was a credit problem. And then the reaction was exactly the same. So I think it's important to understand these cause-effect relationships, but also see them work in history so that you could see where we are now. Because, yes, when we come down to the basics, what is debt? Debt is a promise to deliver money. Money is debt. Debt is money. In other words, when we say money is debt, you don't hold it in paper cash. You hold it in a debt instrument when you're holding money. And a debt instrument is a promise by the government to give you money. And so when you have that dynamic and you say, is it worth a lot to hold? And how much is it? You enter that particular dynamic. So I think it's just so important that people understand that dynamic now. Yes. So as we look ahead, is that money going to be paid back with hard money, with real money? It's either going to be paid back with hard money, real money, that is going to maintain a purchasing power, or it's not, or it's going to be paid back with depreciated money. And in the end, they all devalue or the currencies die. So that creates the nature of what is a monetary inflation. There are two types of inflation. There is the monetary inflation because they create a lot of money and credit and becomes worthless. Or there's the inflation that comes from that there's too much demand pressing up on too much supply. And the situation now is that dynamic of a monetary inflation. So I really urge clients to review that chapter in the book and make sure you understand that, because that value of money is such an important thing.
So I just want to get very tangible, because this is something that I've personally, ever since I've known you, you know, and talked about these issues, that you talk about hard money, and through time, hard money has been traditionally gold, but over time, there's been, you know, other aspects of so-called hard money, or at least things that are considered storeholds of wealth. So just to get very tangible and practical for our listeners, you know, I know gold is something you would hold in your portfolio to protect, help protect against this kind of debasement as a potential risk. Are there other aspects of hard money, whether it's crypto or whether it's particular currencies, that you would consider wise to hold in a portfolio that's allocated towards avoiding or mitigating this type of risk and keeping your real purchasing power?
I'll answer about the portfolio, and the answer to that is, what is an asset that can move between countries that is a real asset and that is widely accepted around the world? That's the nature of the beast. If we're talking about money, a global money, is something that's accepted around the world. You can move it and pay it. And ideally, it's not, there's a saying about gold that it's the only financial asset that you can own that is not somebody else's liability, that you have to get something from something. And I'll just point out that when you asked the question, what I think about was that it was the Dutch in the 1600s that changed our definition, changed our view of money and financial assets, because then there wasn't a stock market. They invented the first stock and the first stock market, and there wasn't much of a bond market. There was a little bit of lending. And what everybody thought their assets were the things they owned. In other words, if you were rich, you would just find that you were rich because you had your house or whatever it is, and you had your business. And they invented the concept that you could buy an interest in income that hasn't yet been made. In other words, I'll buy an interest in a company, and then I will go make the money that I'm going to pay you back with. And that was really the development of financial assets as we know it. And we start to think of assets as being financial assets. And all of those financial assets, all of the financial assets that we have no intrinsic value. They have no purpose intrinsically. You might as well burn them. They're of no use unless you convert them into buying real goods and services. And we lose sight of that. We think that we have a lot of financial assets, and we're storing all of our financial assets. So through history, you can see, and it's shown in the book, you'll see a chart of the amount of financial assets relative to the value of real assets. And when there's a large amount of financial assets, claims on the real assets, that becomes a problem in terms of debt service, becomes a problem in that. And so we then go back to the basic question that you're asking. The basic question that you're asking is, what has real value? Okay. And it's so almost like musical chairs, because all of this money, when it comes down to it, is like, okay, I got to buy something. Where am I going to be my storehold of wealth? Because it may not be as much in those financial assets, particularly the debt assets, because the debt assets are much worse than the equity assets when they start to print the money. So when you start to think about it, real estate is a problem generally, but it depends where the real estate is. We'll get into the geopolitical in a second. But real estate becomes a problem because it's so, first of all, so easily taxed. It's nailed down. Because it's there physically, it's easy to tax. And so it depreciates in value, and you can't pick it up and go buy something in some other country with it. So there starts to think, okay, what are the, is it collectibles? Is it works of art? Is it gems? What is it that, in a sense, can move between those places? And then related to that, because of the nature of the cycle, when there's more trouble because of the confluence of the financial, the internal conflict over wealth and values, and then the external conflict, there become legal changes. In other words, foreign exchange controls and abilities to move money from place to place. These become more important issues. They become considerations in the value of what is of value. And so that whole dynamic then makes one think, well, you could figure it out for yourself. You start to think, okay, what will have value and where? So if you come down to a limited number of choices, right? Gold is one of those choices because it can move from place to place. It's a world money, and it's not requiring somebody to pay and all of that. The characteristics of it are what I'm trying to convey. And then where it is becomes an important consideration. Because in this environment, when you have the internal conflict, and then you also have the external conflict, the question is, where are the safe environments? Where are the safe environments that will protect capital versus, you know, let's say capital is not protected?
So, Ray, you mentioned that, you know, as you think about the financial and economic that you just talked about, that you can't forget. And again, this is the connection between the big forces. And you talked about the internal conflict. So I want you to just explain, if you would, how the internal conflicts that we're basically experiencing right now, how do you see them and how are they coming together with this financial and economic force?
Well, obviously, money matters to people. And when you have a money crisis, and then it's the nature of the system that capitalism will necessarily reward those who come up with, you know, the great ideas and the great and so on. And it creates a wealth gap. And then when it goes from one generation to another generation, then that becomes an unfair thing. And then one man's debts or another man's assets. So there's this financial. And then there's values differences. And so you see who gets the money becomes a big issue. And then the values differences become very great. And so in the 1930 to 45 period, four democracies chose to be autocratic leaders. That was Germany, Italy, Spain, and Japan, because the conflict became so great and each side had populism. By populism, I mean the not willingness to accept losing, that the system, they believe the system isn't fair, and that they want to find the people who will fight and win for them. And when they have those people who will fight and win for them, you have irreconcilable differences. So even questions that we're experiencing now, is the rule of law fair? Is it going to work? If Donald Trump is convicted or Joe Biden is convicted, whatever, do you believe that that's a fair trial? Do both sides accept that? If you accept losing an election, do you accept that? Do you play by the rules or do you play to win? And so what we're seeing now, that we've seen repeatedly, you know, French Civil War, Russian Civil War, Chinese Civil War, Cuban Civil War, Spanish Civil War, all of these cases are when there are irreconcilable differences and the lack of willingness to accept losing. So as we come into this particular, let's call it the next 2 years, which will take us into the beginning part of the next term, this is going to be one of those sort of great conflict. I mean, who would imagine that the legal questions such as that are existing and the sense of, is that fair? So what we're seeing seems very unusual to us, yet it's very typical in terms of these cycles. So that becomes the dynamic. When that dynamic occurs at the same time as the other dynamics occur, then you have sort of that element of the perfect storm. So, for example, as we're getting into the issue of the geopolitical, the conflict with China and the sides lining up the way they're lining up, you also realize that the domestic political issue will tend to exacerbate that conflict over that period of time. So that dynamic coming together is a very classic dynamic that seems very unusual to us now. But if you were to read history and read the stories of how it transpired, I think one needs that perspective.
Ray, as I listen to you, you know, one of the things you talk about is the risk to the rule of law and the breakdown in our democratic system. And clearly those risks are prevalent, especially as we approach the 2024 election. But just in previous conversation with you, I think it's important to point out for our listeners that you're looking at this as a risk as opposed to, let's say, a projection. It could also be the case that democracy has such flexibility in it that the kind of the market corrects and that the middle will once again reassert itself. And so I think it's important to point that out because it's not like you're making a prediction so much as you're essentially assessing a risk that's very prevalent.
So I am echoing what you're saying. What are the great strengths? Democracy means that there's a flexibility. Just abide by the rules. If you obey the rules, then you will get an answer. And everybody says, I surrender to the decision of the majority of the people. And that's a fabulous thing. It's a fabulous that it brings about compromise. It's a fabulous thing that we have rule of law. What happens, and the risk, is the loss of those things.
Right.
So
right.
I'm not against those things. On the contrary, I'm saying cherish those things. Do not lose those things. Because if you lose the rule of law and you lose the acceptance of the votes and that acceptance, that we appear is a possibility.
Right.
Okay. That we should be very scared and that the risks of that are great during the times that such a time that we are in. And so you can see it operating in that way. And in these times where there are irreconcilable differences, that's a period of time. So I am echoing what you're saying. You may not like the rules, but please let's abide by the rules, because when we abandon the rule book, what comes next is terrible.
So that's the end of part one. And in part two of this series, we'll pick up our conversation with Ray, turning to the international world order and what's happening with the major players, including his take on the U.S.-China relationship and China's economy.